Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm, the first cheesemaking co-op in Vermont. For more information, visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening, planet Earth. My name is Chris Kuzmi, and you're listening to For Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett, your co-host, and you're listening to a podcast on all things fermentable with a concentration on beer.
That's right. And today, we have a couple of announcements to make. Mary, what you got over there?
All right. So first of all, the Heritage Radio Network Hawaiian Barbecue is this Sunday, August 11th. They have VIP and general admission tickets available. It's a barbecue, pig roast, campfire, auction. It's going to be a lot of fun. Chris and I are going to be there. The general admission tickets are $95 and gets you in from 5 to 9. That includes cocktails, apps, and a family-style dinner. For more information and tickets, go to hrnhawaiianbbq.eventbrite.com. Oh, and they're going to be serving beer from Empire, so that's always a plus. Then September 8th is the Brooklyn Wort, so that's at the Bell House in Gowanus, Brooklyn. It's basically a big homebrew tasting. There's always some amazing local homebrews there. That's going to be 1 to 5, and tickets are $40. Go to brooklynwort.com for more info.
And Mary and I are actually just back from Belgium Comes to Cooperstown, where we served the second in our Pillow Talk series, which is a kettle-soured saison, and we were also going to serve that on August 25th at the New York City Brewers Guild fundraiser in advance of Beer Week 2014. So that will be taking place at the Well in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Tickets are $50, and you can find more information about that at newyorkcitybrewersguild.com. It's going to be an awesome little event. Some great beers, great lineup. 2 to 5 p.m. Block party action.
Yeah. So I'm excited about tonight's show.
I'm really excited about tonight's show. Tonight's show stems from the Craft Brewers Conference, and I know Mary pretty well. And when she's excited as she was when I saw her moments after a talk that she saw,
actually at NHC.
Oh, sorry, NHC. That's right, National Brewers Conference. She came running to me after seminar with a glass in her hand of some cider that had been barrel aged.
Yeah, it was bourbon. I think it was on bourbon oak.
Bourbon oak. And our guest today stems from this talk.
Yep. So, Chris Banker, welcome. Are you there?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hi, Chris and Mary. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, thanks for being here. So, Chris is a home brewer, cider maker, and cheese maker out in near San Diego, California. Let's start with what have you been fermenting lately?
Lately I've been working on some ciders and some meads. I just got a whole bunch of really good honey from my friend's farm in Louisiana, so I've been doing some work with that. And the usual, making some cheeses.
I am really sad to have missed your talk. I forget which room I was in, but when Mary came back, I was excited about it. Her takeaway is, we're talking about, you have a different process of some of the ciders that you make, and it's not necessarily traditional. First of all, how long have you been making ciders? Where are you coming from with all of these?
I've been making ciders about 4 years. I started homebrewing about 4 years ago, and my second batch was a cider.
That's awesome.
I'm not sure where I got the idea from, but it kind of popped in my head to make a cider, and so I tried it out. I realized very early on that it was a great way to keep my fermenters full.
That's right. How long do your ciders usually, or do you let your ciders ferment?
Typically, my ciders take around 4 weeks, although I've done them as quick as 4 days. And if you don't care about having them clarify, you can really crank something out as soon as fermentation's done.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the reasons I think Mary was so excited, because a lot of people are intimidated about homebrewing in general because of the time it takes and because of, when you make cider, most cider makers use, the specific apples, the specific harvest. But she came back, talked with the cider that I think she brought me were not those apples.
Right. So I think the cool thing is that I think anyone can do your cider process and probably make very good cider, a very drinkable, lovely beverage. So tell us a little bit about your process, the materials that you start with, your process, and also how you kind of came up with a process.
Sure. So my process is really simple, and it relies on everyday ingredients that you can pick up at the grocery store and homebrew shop. And it's just a very simple process that you can do year-round. So I start off with regular grocery store apple juice. That can be from Trader Joe's or your local grocery store or Costco. Really anything that doesn't have sulfites or sulfates, which is surprisingly uncommon to actually have those preservatives. Most people think if you went to the store, anything you find would have preservatives, and that's actually completely opposite. I have yet to find any apple juice at the store that has any of those preservatives.
That's great.
And so from there, you just you add some nutrients. I like to give the yeast a good start by adding some nutrients in the form of diammonium phosphate for free amino nitrogen, okay, and some Firmaid K, which is a wine nutrient. So those nutrients give the yeast a healthy start and give it something to work with, because the apple juice doesn't have the nutrients that beer would. And then you basically just add yeast and let it go. I don't usually even worry about oxygenation, since I'm usually dumping the juice in pretty violently. That splashes it enough to get some oxygen in there.
Very cool. Now, speaking of yeast, that was one of the more interesting things about your seminar, is that your homebrew club, Quaff, which is San Diego-based, did a project with White Labs. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
So tell us a little bit about that project. Like, what yeast were you using before? How did the project come about? And what were some of your key takeaways or recommendations?
So the way this project came about was that one of our members, Stan Sisson, who also makes a lot of ciders, saw that the AHA was asking for research projects that they could fund, asking homebrew clubs to take advantage of that opportunity to run experiments. And so he got together with some other cider makers in the area who were interested in joining with this, and talked to White Labs to get them to help sponsor it. And we devised this experiment where we had 7 cider makers on board. Each person picked a different yeast that they wanted to work with, and we made all the ciders in a controlled manner so that we all used the same base apple juice, same process, all the same steps, and somewhat similar timelines. We did some lager yeast that we gave a little bit more time. But it was a fairly controlled experiment so that we could try how these different yeasts would affect the ciders that we were making.
What were the results?
So the results were somewhat surprising in that I've always really liked the WLP500 Trappist yeast, and that came out kind of middle bottom of the results. Some of the things I learned from it were that most popular was WLP002 English Ale, and that the main reason for that is that didn't ferment out all the way and produced a much sweeter cider. That's something I've kind of known all along, is that I always prefer a little bit sweeter cider, and so I typically back sweeten my ciders after fermentation's done. And so people really did like that slightly sweeter cider that gives support for either back sweetening, using yeast that won't ferment all the way, or find some other way to have it be sweeter. Then another surprise was the number 2 result was Edinburgh Ale yeast, which did ferment out all the way. That had a really nice flavor for being such a dry cider, had some nice spice notes coming through. So that was very enjoyable, and I've actually started to work with that more now, you know, based on these results. One thing to note about the results of this are the fact that these were all dry ciders, so we didn't add any additional back sweetening. These were fermented out as far as the yeast would go during the experiment.
And how many weeks did you guys give? I mean, with the exception of the lager yeast?
These were typically given about a month.
Okay.
That's way cool. It's very fun. We did a little experiment at our house with the same way, but we let it go really long.
That's true. Yeah. But we did, so I did actually pick up some apple juice from Costco. We have not made the cider yet, but I am re-inspired, and we are going to do that this week. So I know that you're doing, so tell us a little bit about, you've been using this Edinburgh yeast since, and what are some of your other experiences with it?
I had only used that for Scottish ales in the past, and strong Scotch ales, So I didn't have any experience with it for ciders. It was something someone liked for other beers and decided to test out as part of this. But I've been using it lately, and the initial results have been tasting good.
Very cool. And then you do some flavored. So I know at NHC, during your seminar, you served a cherry cider, and then you served this the cider that was aged with, I believe it was bourbon oak chips.
Yeah, that's correct.
So what would you... Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to know more about my process is that it's very conducive to specialty ciders and fruit ciders. Because honestly, the base cider you're going to get is going to be tasty and drinkable, but won't have a lot of varietal character. And so it's more enjoyable to try different things with it and try adding fruit and in other cases aging on things. So two of my favorites are a tart cherry cider where I back sweeten with this tart cherry syrup. The ingredients in that are just cherry juice and sugar, and so that gives it a nice cherry flavor, a slight pink hue. And then, as you mentioned, the bourbon oak cider, what I do there is I soak some oak chips on bourbon and then age the cider on that, and it takes on a nice bourbon and oak character.
And how long do you recommend that people, like, are you boiling your oak chips first and then soaking them? And how long do you typically recommend that people leave if they're going to experiment with wood-aged ciders?
So I'm not typically boiling them. I put the oak chips right into the bourbon and let it soak for a minimum of a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let them have some time to absorb the bourbon and take on some character. Then what I do is in secondary, or if I don't care about harvesting the yeast cake and I'm not planning to age for a really long time, I'll just throw those oak chips right into primary after the fermentation's complete.
Okay. And how long and are you leaving them?
Typically 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
And I would say a minimum of 2 weeks. But you could go as long as it takes to get some good character out of them. With oak chips, you're probably not going to get much after 4 or 5 weeks. If you were to use oak cubes, you could go much longer and get the more complex flavors out of them. And so that's a great thing to experiment with if you've got some more time and are willing to let it go for longer term.
Mm-hmm.
What's your ratio of oak chips per liquid?
So for a 5-gallon batch, I'm using about 1.5 to 2 ounces of oak chips.
Mm-hmm.
Typically toasted.
That's...
And then one other thing I do is after the aging on oak chips is done, I reserve the liquid that I didn't pour into the batch, and I'll dose it with that to taste. And so when you take the oak chips out of the bourbon, you've got this really oaky bourbon, much more oaky than any bourbon you'd get off the shelf. And so you can dose it back with that. That gives it some more oak and bourbon character, and I do that to taste. Typically about half of the liquid that was required to cover the oak chips initially.
Okay. And that's for a 5-gallon batch. Now, I think one thing about this, you know, your non-traditional technique of making cider is that you could do it in any batch size. So I can envision people doing, you know, gallon batches, 2-gallon batches, whatever, especially if we're talking about, you know, urban city dwellers that don't have much room or equipment. There's no heat, there's no time required. It seems to me that this is a very easy project to do, you know, when you get home from work at night or whenever. Do you find that's typically
true? Yeah, it's extremely easy. Yeah, it's a really easy process that requires very little equipment. And so, you know, a great way to get started is to go to the store and buy one of those 1-gallon jugs of organic apple juice, pour off a little bit and drink it, and put some yeast in there, put it and slap AirLac on the top. And you've got a nice little 1-gallon batch of cider.
Right. And no equipment. I mean, other than, you know, somehow rigging your AirLac to the lid.
Depending, putting
in a bung or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really. A lot of those jugs actually fit the standard small universal carboy AirLac or carboy bung. And so you can just get one of those and AirLac. It's all $2 or so at the homebrew shop. And do that small batch cider, and that's a nice way to experiment with some different things.
Absolutely. Are there some other flavors that you've been toying with that you really like, or maybe something that you've done that you're like, I don't really love this?
Well, a couple that I do really like are every fall, we have a lot of winemaking happen in San Diego, and we have a local winemaking shop. And the shop ends up with all this grape pomace, the leftover seeds, skins from the grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives away gallon Ziploc bags that she fills up of that pomace. What I do is I collect a bunch of that in the fall and stick it in my freezer.
and I'll put some of that into secondary for aging. And that makes it take on a great, you know, kind of a rosé wine character, a combination of the cider and the red wine. I really like the red wine grapes for that. It gives it a nice tannic quality.
That sounds awesome, actually. That sounds really fun.
Absolutely.
Good on you.
Yeah, I really like that. And so if you have access to some of those wine grape pomace, that's just stuff winemakers are throwing out.
Very cool. So we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back in a couple minutes with Chris Banger, and we're going to talk, we'll finish up our cider discussion. We're going to talk about home cheese making, so stay tuned.
The Manabat.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Today's program has been brought to you by Consider Bardwell Farm.
Spanning the rolling hills of Vermont's Champlain Valley and easternmost Washington County, New York, 300-acre Consider Bardwell Farm was the first cheese-making co-op in Vermont, founded in 1864 by Consider Stebbins Bardwell himself. Rotational grazing on pesticide-free and fertilizer-free pastures produces the sweetest milk and the tastiest cheese. All of their cheeses are aged on the farm in their extensive system of caves.
Consider Bardwell Farm is also a big supporter of Heritage Foods USA's No Goat Left Behind program. No Goat Left Behind is a serious effort launched in 2011 by Heritage Foods USA, designed to introduce goat meat to American diners and provide a sustainable end market for dairy animals.
For more information, please visit www.considerbardwellfarm.com.
Welcome back to Foment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. So, this is Chris and Mary. We're talking to Chris Banker in California about cider and cheese making. So, before we move on to cheese making, I have to ask, Chris. So, I noticed that you posted a photo on Facebook that you got a bunch of local organic peaches and nectarines, and I'm dying to know what you're going to do with those.
So, my plan right now is to do about half of my share of that for mead. I started last night, and I'm planning to start a cider tonight to use half of that. So, yeah, that'll be a peach nectarine cider.
Awesome. That sounds delicious. It's also peach. We're in peach season here in New York City. And Chris and I have been eating them from the Green Market. And actually, we did a beer. At 508, we infused a sour beer with peaches, but we haven't done a water kefir or anything, so I'm definitely inspired to go get some peaches and do some other fermenting with them.
So yeah, actually, one of my favorite ciders that I do often is peach apricot cider. Mm. I use some of the Trader Joe's Dixie peach juice for the initial juice, and then in the past I've aged on dried apricots, but you could certainly use fresh peaches, apricots, nectarines.
Mm-hmm. Or some combination. Now, are you also using apple cider along with the Trader Joe's peach juice?
Yeah, I am. I'm just using a portion of it. Typically, one bottle initially, in addition to the rest being apple juice for a 5-gallon batch. And for that, I've usually used one bottle as the back sweetening in that. So that gives it a nice, fresh peach juice flavor at the end.
Absolutely. Now, when you back sweeten, are you doing anything else to stop the fermentation, or are you just kegging and drinking it very fresh?
So it depends on what I'm planning to do with it. If I'm planning to serve it all off of tap, then I'll just keep it cold in the kegerator and serve it until it's gone. If I'm planning to bottle it and save bottles, you do need to arrest the fermentation. And so to do that, I typically use potassium sorbate and Campton tablets. And so that will prevent any further yeast activity and prevent the yeast from kicking back up.
Right.
Just you can certainly just kill it off. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can certainly just keep it cold, and the yeast won't kick back up typically.
When do you add that? Do you add that at the same time as you do the fruit addition if you wanted the back sweet, or you've wanted that sweet fruit to stay, or do you let the fruit
I'm typically aging on the fruit, and so I'm not killing off the yeast until I put it into the keg. I typically do that at kegging time.
Okay.
I confused the mead recently because I put in the strawberries. I was like, here, have some sugar, but please stop. And so I put the pasteurized sorbet at the same time, and it didn't really stop. I think that, went for it until we finally chilled it.
Yeah, I like the idea of not doing anything, but just, kegging and keeping it cool, not adding any preservatives. I think that's a nice option for people. So let's move on to cheese making. So I know that you didn't talk about this in your seminar, but when I Googled you, of course, which I have to do, it came up that you're a cheese maker as well, and you're the founder and president of Queso Diego, which is San Diego's cheese club. So how did you get into cheese making?
Oh, I got into cheese making through homebrewing. A member of my homebrew club, Horace Bixby, offered up a free cheese making class to our club about 3 years ago, maybe. He offered it to the homebrew club, and I went as well as about a dozen or so other members of the club. And he gave us kind of a quick intro on homebrewing and told us about the basics and where to get supplies, and we kind of organized from there to do a group order for kits.
Very cool. And then, so what were some of your first cheeses that you made?
I started with, I think my first was probably mozzarella, and I did some ricotta and some fresh goat cheeses. And around when I started to get into hard cheeses was when I got more serious about it and realized that I needed a resource for information and wanted to start a club.
So going back to that, are those very simple cheeses to make? Is that why you started there?
Yeah,
we have not
simple.
Done a cheese show, and I don't know nothing about the process. So could you give me the 101 on mozzarella?
Sure. So there's a very quick and easy process for mozzarella that's promoted by Ricky Carroll of New England Cheesemaking Supply.
Yep.
And it's she calls it her 20-minute mozzarella process.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, you add some cultures to the milk and heat it up to form a curd. And then you take that curd and you can reheat it in either the microwave or over the stove, and that's when you stretch it. So you heat it up enough to get it to the point where the curd stretches. And that's how you get that curd formation that you're expecting in mozzarella that's kind of stringy.
And the curd is basically the solid part in the cheese making, right?
Yeah, like solid proteins and milk solids.
Okay.
And, yeah, so that's really simple. Ricotta is even simpler. You heat to a higher temperature, and that separates the curd from the whey, and you just run that through cheesecloth.
The curd. And then you'll get, I've actually made ricotta. I took a workshop, and then I've made it at home, too, in the past. Tell us a little bit about, hard cheese is a little bit trickier, I know, and takes longer. So what were your mozzarella and ricotta are all fresh cheeses. They don't really go through a fermentation process.
Yeah.
But then the hard cheeses, what are some of the cheeses that you've made? And tell us about your equipment.
So I've done cheddar and Gouda, Swiss, Jack. So I've done several different hard cheeses, and that's definitely more of a process. It's more like a brew day type process where it takes on the order of 6 hours or so.
Okay.
And so you do need to dedicate some time, either an evening or a weekend day. But there's a lot of downtime where you can hang out and watch a movie or whatever.
Just like brewing.
So you're asking about my equipment. So I actually adapted my electric homebrew system to work for cheese making. And I realized that I had made this 10-gallon electric homebrew system that has a digital control system and everything. And I realized that I had a 5-gallon pot that easily fit inside of the keg that I use as my kettle.
Mm-hmm.
So I could adapt it to be a giant double boiler. And so what I do is I fill the kettle with water and put the pot in it. There's enough space to slide a hose down the side and inside the kettle. So I run my March pump with recirculating water. So I've got a water bath constantly recirculating around the inner pot.
Mm-hmm.
That lets me very precisely control my temperatures.
That's, yeah.
Yeah, and I just actually threw up a link to your website. So if people that are listening, I just tweeted from the Femen About It account a link to Chris's cheesemaking equipment because it's very, very cool.
Excellent.
So what do you recommend for somebody that is interested in getting, obviously, you know, mozzarella, I think mozzarella and ricotta are definitely the way to start. But what do you recommend for somebody that wants to go to the fermented cheeses, who wants to make a cheddar or a Monterey Jack or something?
I'd recommend just starting out with what you've got in your kitchen, especially if you've got a large pot. I was doing 3-gallon batches with my 5-gallon brew pot in the sink, and just using, if you've got hot enough water, you can just use the hot water from your sink to regulate the temperature.
Okay.
And so you can use one of the basins of your sink as a giant double boiler, or you can use your brew pot as the outer pot, and this one of your other large pots as the inner one.
Mm-hmm.
Most people can find some way to do at least a gallon double boiler sort of setup in their kitchen.
And then how about the fermentation process? Where are you actually aging your cheeses?
So I have a little wine fridge that I found on Craigslist for $25 or $30. One of those little digitally controlled wine fridges that holds 12 bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great because it covers the temperature range you're looking for cheese, which is typically around 55 degrees. And you can find those pretty readily available. People get them as wedding gifts and decide that's not something they actually need.
Yep.
And so you just dial in the temperature and you can age in there.
Now, do you have to worry about humidity when you're doing that?
So to some extent you do, but you can certainly manage that manually. And one thing that I've found that works really well is as soon as the cheeses are done air drying, which is when you'd wax them, mm-hmm. I actually vacuum seal it instead of waxing. And that completely seals it and maintains the proper humidity inside of that. You don't have to worry about any contamination getting through or pinholes in the wax.
Wow.
Right. Very cool. And I know that we own one of those for hops and other stuff. So a lot of homebrewers order one. Yeah, have one. That's very cool. And then let's talk about the Queso Diego. I think that's absolutely fantastic that you guys have a cheese club. What are some of the activities that you do, and what do you recommend for people that are looking to start a home cheesemaking, group?
Okay. Yeah, I'll start by how I got started with Queso Diego. So when I was starting to get more into cheesemaking, I realized that I didn't really have a good resource for asking questions as I progressed. I knew there were a few people who were more experienced around town.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of put together a Google Groups email list and just started asking some of the homebrewers and cheesemakers in the area to get on it. And so that kind of worked as an email list for about 6 months with some nice discussion. And then people started kind of beg me to meet everyone and get together a meeting. So I somewhat reluctantly put something together, and we met at Ale Smith, which is a local brewery in the area, and had a great turnout. I think we had about 35 or 40 people show up and almost as many cheeses. And at that point, it was really clear that people were looking to meet other cheesemakers and share their cheeses and creations. So we decided that night that we needed to make this a real club and start having meetings and get officers together.
Very cool. And what are some of the meetings, what do you guys do at your meetings or some of the activities that you guys have done?
We try to alternate between educational meetings and activity-based meetings.
Mm-hmm.
This year's theme has been Cheeses of the World, so a lot of the educational meetings have been themed around geographic regions. For example, next month we're doing Brazil. I'm not very familiar with Brazilian cheeses, and we have a member of the club who's from Brazil and goes to Brazilian markets that carry some imported cheeses. And so we're going to try out different Brazilian cheeses, talk about how they're made and what's common between them, try out Brazilian drinks, maybe do some dancing.
Awesome.
Nice. I have a quick question. I know we don't have very much time left, but my family is from Ecuador, South America, and we have a fresh cheese, the fresh white cheese. Basically, in the morning, somebody would come home from the market with some fresh goat cheese or cow milk, and they would put it on the stove and drop some tablet in there, and then by the afternoon, we had this crazy white cheese that was salty and lovely. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, the tablet was rennet.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can buy junket tablets at the store, at the grocery store, but they're not very good. You're much better off getting good cheesemaking rennet from a cheesemaking supplier.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that with just normal milk, can you? It has to be unpasteurized. Is that true?
No, it's fine if it's pasteurized. Just avoid ultra-pasteurized, which is a very high-temperature pasteurization that denatures the protein so much that you really can't form a curd.
Okay.
And just look for that ewe. If it says ewe or ultra-pasteurized on it, avoid that. But most of the stuff you can find at the stores will be completely fine.
This is awesome. I've been trying to do this. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, but I haven't been able to. We are just about out of time, but I want to drive home the fact that you can make your own cider. You can make great cider from products from the local grocery store.
Year round. In your tiny apartment.
And that one of the more fun parts of that is you can doctor it and do other stuff to make it more interesting with local fruits and whiskey aged oak chips.
Yeah.
And if you're a home brewer and you want to make cheese, you can convert your equipment that you already have and dive into this. And I think we should start doing that, Mary. I think we should make cheese.
Oh, cheese making. It's on the list. That's what we're doing next weekend.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, Chris. I also want to say, if you're an American Homebrewers Association member, Chris's entire seminar from the June's NHC is now available online, both the audio and the PowerPoint. So I would suggest, if you weren't there, to download it and take a listen. It was really spectacular.
Big shout out to Quaff.
Yep. And Queso Diego.
Tune
in next week. We're going to be talking to Michaela Hayes of Crock and Jar about fermented vegetables and community fermentation projects.
Chris Banker, thank you so much, man.
Yeah. Cheers.
Fermented about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.